The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's edition. And tonight we have an interesting guest for you who is, actually I'm not sure exactly where he is. I guess we'll find out here in just a moment. James, are you with us?
Hi, Soraya. Greetings from Ireland.
Ireland, okay.
And I'm in Northern Ireland, the very, very top. Sometimes I say Ireland, sometimes I say UK, but but I do travel a bit too, so I can understand your predicament there.
Yeah, because I remember you saying you jump between that area and what, Sweden?
Yeah, my mum, well, and Copenhagen and Denmark, but they're just over the bridge from each other. But yeah, my mum's from Copenhagen, and she has a holiday home in Sweden that I sometimes go over once a month with her. So
we'll just say you're calling in from Europe.
Yeah,
we'll be safe.
Europe can fit inside America, so we got like 40 countries over here. It's so confusing for you guys, but yeah, so, you wouldn't normally get many people going from to and from Ireland and Denmark, I suppose. Like,
now
wouldn't be a strong connection.
Northern Ireland, so that's going to be kind of cold at this point.
Oh my God! I was just in Malta looking at some temples for the equinox, and you know, I came back home and I went from 20 degrees Celsius, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but to nearly freezing temperatures, 3 degrees. absolutely freezing snow, ice. I mean, it's supposed to be springtime here. It shouldn't really be this bad, but it's really bad at the moment.
Yeah, it's pretty bad here too, actually, in upstate New York. Winter started right on the first day of winter, but we've now passed the first day of spring and it's still winter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the same thing's happened here. We've got this really cold snap that's come out of nowhere and right on the equinox too, so.
All right, so now you've written a few books.
Yeah, I'm actually just finished the sequel to what we're going to talk about tonight, The New Grain Serious Mystery. But yes, I've also done another book. It's a digital publication that's in getting reworked at the moment, and it's called Hidden History, Secret Science, and it's a lot about historical mysteries. And I used to write for a historical mysteries magazine, I think, would be the thing to say. And you know, that's going to be put back out for the fall. So I'm reworking a couple of titles because I've done a lot of self-publishing, Soraya. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've just finished my second one now, The New Grange Acoustics Mystery. And it's a follow-up to my first book, The New Grange Serious Mystery. And yeah, I guess the both of them, I was aware of both areas of research when I was writing The New Grain Serious Mystery. I was aware of the acoustics element, and you know, I took some acoustics measurements alongside my astronomical measurements, and you know, that was more laborious than taking the astronomy measurements. And at the time, I didn't know where I was going with it. I wasn't kind of sure what I would do with it. Was it necessity? But that's all proved good to me, you know, and I guess the thing to say is, you know, it's proved more rewarding than the astronomy, because my second book, the sequel, the acoustics book, is going to be like a lot more impacting than the astronomy book. And for a number of reasons, like it also explains the rock art for, you know, this paranormal effect of altered states of consciousness and you know, the effects of the human consciousness with sound inside these chambers. They're, I kind of should say that these passage graves we're talking about, you know, they're like astronomical observatories first and foremost on the outside, but inside they're like sound chambers that can affect the human brain and at special frequencies. And the rock art that's depicted on these passage graves, Soraya, you know, they're astronomy based, and they're also indicating altered states of consciousness, like typical art would be called entoptic phenomena, you know.
Right, and right,
you know, so it's a multifaceted, complex structure that we're going to talk about tonight, Sarai.
Yeah, well, let's start down at the beginning. Now, when did this book come out?
The book was this one. The Newgrain Serious Mystery was released on the shelf for November 30th of last year. So it's not out very long, but I've had such good, rewarding feedback for it so far. It's been quite good for me now.
Okay, how did you get involved in studying this?
Yeah, kind of a funny one, Sarai. I kind of got drawn into it. As I said, I wrote for Historical Histories magazine, and I wanted to compile my historical mysteries into kind of an encyclopedia of historical mysteries, if you want to call it that. Ancient contact between cultures, like transoceanic contact in ancient times, stuff like that. The Egyptians, the Mayans, the megalithic civilization of Western Europe. And in an effort to compile all these different articles, I came to write a chapter on the megalithic civilization. But in doing so, I ended up doing a bit of research locally where I'm at in the north of Ireland, in a place called Donegal, and I discovered some rock art that was incorrectly deciphered, if you want to call it that. And I didn't feel it needed deciphering. I just seen it for what it was, Soraya, and it was done wrong. And basically, it's in the book. It's called the Ardmore Equinox Stone, and there's two constellations. They're quite well known. They're the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper. They're the Big Plough, the Little Plough, Ursa Major, Ursa Minor. There's loads of different names for these, and it's what navigators would use in the Northern Hemisphere for navigating at sea. The Big Plough would be, and finding the North Star. I seen the two constellations on it, and they seem to flip each other at 6 months of the year, on the 21st of March, on the 21st of September. And I've seen this complex astro-megalithic rock art at play. And you know, these guys were saying, look, they even had a notch on top of the stone to say that they were flipping this image 6 months apart. And, it was very advanced, and it was very obvious to me, like. But I only seen one reference of this stone and rock art as a decipherment, and it was wrong, and it stood out as being wrong. You know, I couldn't even see this other rock art being deciphered in any other way. Now, there is other markings on the stone, I granted that, but so in my attempt to go and explore, I went, you know, what else has been done wrong? Or, you know, and I said, let's look at some of the rock art. You know, I think that was the key thing I did, Soraya. You know, I started looking at rock art that was near the megalithic tombs, or the stuff that had astronomy calculations on it, or astronomy-based megalithic rock art. Now, there's not a lot of that, Soraya. And the key thing is, Ireland possesses an awful lot of rock art. And when you go to Newgrange, you've got 40% of the rock art of Europe on that one site alone. And that's... Wow. That's how much is there. It's astounding. When you go to Newgrange, you know, don't get me wrong now. I mean, it's astounding just to look at the monument and see what they did. And you go to Noth, about a kilometre away, there's another passage grave there. And then you go to Doth, it's another passage grave 2 kilometres there. And they're equal-sized mounds. They're dominating on the landscape. They're monstrous-like, you know. And the amount of man hours that was taken to build this and use these big multi-ton curbs and decorate them, and the design of the sunlight coming in and penetrating the passages, and, you know, all that goes with that. But also the rock art that's on the curbs, like, you know, it's depicting very intense, complex themes. Hmm. Now, people tend to flock to Newgrange, Soraya, to figure out Newgrange, like, you know, and my approach was different. I went, no, you can't do that. You can't just go to one passage grave and say you figured it out. No, you can, and you can say you figured out this part of it, or you can say you figured out that part, and everybody wants to go and crack Newgrange and decipher that bit of rock art, and that's great. That's, I understand that, you know, but you have to look at the whole thing. You have to look at the whole problem, and you have to look at the whole complexity of it, and that means going around the whole of Ireland and looking at all these passage graves. So then I got drawn into the passage graves, and I seemed to attach myself to that one aspect for a very good reason. Number one is they were astronomical observatories. There's good astronomy there to figure out what they did. And I started getting led down a path of discovery, Soraya. And that's kind of what I tried to do in the book, was unravel this passage grave cosmology. I wanted to kind of deliver it and show what these guys were doing first and foremost. Now, basically, that involves the summer solstice, the winter solstice, the spring and autumn equinox. These guys built monuments and tried to capture a beam of sunlight on this day. And I said to myself, okay, why did they do that? What I quickly realized, and other researchers have remarked on this, is that, you know, they hammered out these days, they figured out these days that they could capture the equinox because they knew they were watching the sky on the same day. Like, you had 4 points of the year, spring, autumn, summer, and winter. And these special days, these 4 points of the year that you could observe the stars. Now, this is very evident at Newgrange and Note, and indeed Dote as well, in the Boyne Valley, these three main passage graves of the Boyne Valley, you know, that they have rock art depicting constellations. You know, you got some say the Orion constellation, but most prominently is the Pleiades. It's looking at its own image in the sky when the monument was built, and they were telling us that. And there's evidence of lunar calculations, and you can calculate lunar numbers. And, you know, there's reasons for figuring out all this astronomical play because the rock art is there associated with the alignments. You know, so there's a natural discovery process, but I guess the thing to say then is, where does it lead? You know, and so I tried to compile this passage grave cosmology, and, you know, it was much of a journey of discovery just from that kind of one piece of rock art in Donegal, I suppose, Soraya. You know, I got led down this avenue of, you know, bringing my astronomy background and my engineering background to the table and going, this is my set of eyes, this is what I am seeing. But let's talk about the complexity of all the passage graves. Don't just single out one and say you figured out this megalithic civilization, because it doesn't work like that. You know, you can't say you know everything about a civilization. You have to compile it all together. And these guys had a cosmology, Soraya. Now, every passage grave complex that you go to, you know, these guys have got different names. You've got passage graves, megalithic tombs, passage tombs, megalithic cairns. These are all the same type of monument. They circular mounds, big curbstones, and they capture a beam of sunlight or starlight or moonlight. And, you know, they seem to figure out the motions of the heavens. And each place that you go to, there's several of these complexes in Ireland. And I've concentrated on Ireland for a reason, because that's where all the rock art is. And, you know, my mum's Danish, you know, and I've been to the ones in Denmark, and I've been to the ones in Holland, and I've been to the ones in Brittany, and I've been all around Europe, you know, but they lack a lot of rock art. I think Brittany is the most... Gavrinus is the most decorated passage grave, but setting that aside, there's very few have rock art, and to have the rock art there to help you figure things out is a godsend. So, you know, I confined my efforts to the ones in Ireland for the time being, but the second book I've gone into, the other ones in Europe too. But you know, I think that's probably just the main frame of what I was doing in the book, assimilate this passage grave cosmology and see where it leads, you know. I guess that's it in a nutshell, I suppose.
And why are they called passage graves?
Well, on the basically, a beam of light will come down. Talked about Newgrange first and foremost, because it's the most famous passage grave there is. It's got a winding passageway into its inner chamber. And this beam of sunlight will come in on the shortest day of the year through a light box above the doorway entering the passage. Now, light goes in straight lines. It goes in above your head and above the passageway until it hits the inner chamber. And this chamber has a 20-meter long passage. That's about 60 feet.
Wow.
Now, yeah, so it penetrates into this chamber quite far, but the passageway meanders a slight bit, yeah? It wiggles in and out so that it blocks the light from the doorway. It naturally filters out the light from the doorway, but the light above the light box still comes inside the chamber. Huh. So it's very sophisticated and very advanced, and it's why everybody refers to Newgrange when they're talking about passage graves, because it's the best example in Ireland. It's the most pristine. It's watertight for 5,000 years. Like, it's older than the pyramids of Egypt, like, if you take the present dating of the pyramids. But
Now, is it an actual grave as well?
Yeah, well, it's a grave in the sense that they found cremated bones and ashes inside. So they've cremated the dead outside, and brought them inside. Hmm. Now, not all passage graves will have cremated remains found inside, but a lot of them do. Certainly the ones in Ireland, they're typical for findings. But the ones in Malta, they haven't found... they call them temples over there. They don't call them passage graves. But typically, they're the same outline. They've got recesses inside the chambers, same type of internal layout, same capturing the beam of sunlight on the equinox. And, you know, so some of them across Europe don't have ashes, but that's only because of the age, and they've been stripped away of their mound, and all's left is the passageway. But if you go to the ones in Denmark, Denmark's pretty much the passageway isn't as dominant. Some of them don't have as long a passage. I mean, the Noth one beside Newgrange has the longest passage in Europe. So each one has a slightly different feature, and the passageway can be quite short, like about 5 meters, 15 feet, you know, to about 60 feet. The general structure is always the same. And you've got some quite baby ones of these as well, like little baby ones with it's such a small passage that they're just called cairns. The name changes. So, yeah, it's passage tombs, basically burials found inside, and the passageways there to access you into an inner chamber, which is quite a big chamber. I mean, it's got a corbelled vault ceiling, and you can stand up inside of it, in the central chamber.
Right.
But now, I mean, it's a bit of a misnomer to call them passage graves because they were predominantly for observing the heavens, first and foremost. And something I state in the book, I like to think of them as astronomical observatories, first and foremost, and burial rites second.
Now, are the people who are buried there, are they contemporary with the building, or did that happen later on?
Yeah, you've got carbon dating there, and typical of the date of the building, and it also ties in with the astronomy. So yes, there's a carbon dating of 3500 BC for the Carrowkeel passage graves or passage tombs, and that's synonymous with my astronomical dating with precession at about 3500 BC. So that fits in quite nicely, and that's nice to see that. Newgrange has been carbon dated to about 3200 BC, 3100 BC, on a couple of occasions. Again, Noth beside Newgrange, it's similar again. But there's evidence that there was land reclamation and alteration around Newgrange around 4000 BC. So, you know, they're a bit shady on some of the dating, but typically... Mm. 3200 BC to 3000 BC is the general dating for most of these passage graves, though some of them are slightly bit older. But there's also different phases. They talk about this 3500 BC phase and the 3200 BC phase. So they're built over a few centuries, Soraya, yeah?
Yeah. Do we know who built them? Do we have any idea who built them?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to profile these guys, Soraya, and it's something which you picked up on in the book that I didn't elaborate on too much in the book, but, and in fairness, I kind of didn't want to do that. I wanted to treat the book as an archaeoastronomy book and kind of leave it as academic as I could.
And you did. You didn't really speculate at all in the book. You were pretty much just straight-line facts until the very end where you threw out a couple of brief hints of speculation, and that was it.
I was very reserved, and that's fair enough for you to say that, Soraya. I guess that's the thing, you know, and I kind of wanted to have this archaeoastronomy data book for researchers as well, because there wasn't, this is the thing, Soraya, there wasn't one out there when I had it, so that's why I kind of put it together as an archaeoastronomy research. Now, I'm going to be a bit more freer in the sequel to do this because, you know, I'm being led down that route and I have more evidence to tie in the Dogon element. But the key thing that I'm finding is, first and foremost, they're a seafaring nation that built this because you have to look outside Ireland. The problem with Newgrange and people that come and look at Newgrange, they only look at Newgrange. And if you're lucky, they'll look at a few other ones around. But, I mean, and then... I'm kind of putting all the passage graves in Ireland together to look at their passage grave cosmology. But, you know, I've been all around Europe looking at these things. And, you know, you have to look at the wider European perspective. You can't say that you're going to look at the Irish ones and the Dutch people, they're going to look at the Dutch ones and the Danish are going to look at the Danish ones. And, you know, these guys aren't talking to each other. Not only that, they're speaking different languages, Soraya. Now, my benefit is I've been to various ones. I mean, it's a bit of an obsession going around looking at these places, and I've targeted one particular aspect of the megalithic civilization, but you have to kind of profile what these guys did, where they were at in Europe, to kind of figure out who they were. And you keep being led down this route that they're a seafaring nation. They came by sea. And the more I look at it, I think they're refugees. I think they were refugees. Now, whether that's from a cataclysm or whether that's from, you know, some other function, I don't know. But, I mean, I keep refugees by boat is the only thing that you can really apply that really works. Hmm. Now, the reason for that is because these guys are building similar type monuments. I mean, you can go to Malta, where I've just been, and it's so nice to see so many elements of my work tie in over there. Now, Malta's a long distance from Scotland and the north of Ireland, where these things occur at, and indeed the northeast of Ireland. You know, so that's two ends of the megalithic civilization. You know, they occur in southern Portugal, northwest Spain, northwest France, one region in Holland called Drenthe, and all around Denmark and some parts of southern Sweden as well. Now, you know, why would a civilization spread itself so thinly, Soraya, that they don't incorporate all the elements of the civilization? You know, mm-hmm. So you wouldn't take your civilization and spread it as far as you can, you know, and barely survive and barely transmit all the knowledge. So the thing is, you've got parts of the civilization that are furthest from each other tying in with each other rather than parts of the civilization that are closer to each other. So it's like, you know, a sunken continent, call it Atlantis, call it High Brazil. You know, people always refer to High Brazil as the other Atlantis, and I did go into that at the end of the book, mm-hmm. and I got into that a bit further in the sequel, and, you know, I am looking for that civilization still. I'll be looking a long time, Soraya. I'll probably spend the rest of my life looking for that without any answers, but, you know, I'm building up a picture, and I guess that's the thing I'm trying to tell you. Now, there is evidence that there is a sunken landmass off the coast of Ireland, but I don't think that's the only sunken landmass, and I don't think it's the only answer.
And for people who aren't familiar with that is what is on old maps that is labeled as High Brazil.
Yeah, that's correct. And people think it comes from the Gaelic Irish. The name High Brazil comes from I Brazil, which is originally UI transformed into HY for E on high. And the Brazil is from the clan Brazel, which again is the etymology root of the High Brazil name. But yeah, I mean, High Brazil is on maps off the coast of Ireland, about 100 miles off. And this is the funny thing, Soraya, there is a sandbank there. Now, it's not just on one map, it's on many ancient maps. And it's always drawn in the same place, and it's always drawn to the same size of landmass, about the size of Greater London, 25 miles in diameter. Now, this landmass is there underneath the ocean in a sandbank, and the sandbank's called Porcupine Bank. You know, when I came across this in my research, and I thought, you know, let's put that in there, because at least it's based on fact. There's some academic facts there to back that up in Porcupine Bank, and it's also there in cartography of ancient maps, and right. You know, so there's something there tangible there to mention, and I thought it was worthy of a mention. So I did touch on that a little bit in the book. It was a bit going off topic, but I didn't want to leave the readers unhinged too, Soraya. So I guess that's why I put that one in. But I also tied in some elements of the Dogon, and, you know, yeah. Another thing, you know, I've since come up with more elements of the Dogon sun wheel. They're called sun wheels that I go into. Some of the art that typifies the breaking down of the solar year into four parts and then eight parts. And that's what the Dogon use today. The old Dogon also used a spiral. Now, if you follow the work of Laird Scranton, he will tell you that, you know, the Dogon marched out of ancient Egypt, and there's a very strong links with the Dogon in ancient Egypt. Now, Malta is not far. It's quite close to the coast of Tunisia, and I can see how that can happen there in Malta too. But you know, these doggone sunwheels appear in the Loch Crew. The Loch Crew passage graves, which are about 40 kilometers from Newgrange. Now, why is this doggone symbology occurring there? There's also evidence that a black race of people came by boat to build a Callanish stone temple, which is synonymous with the megalithic civilization. It's like the Stonehenge of Scotland, basically, people refer to it as.
And you were saying, as black race, it's unclear whether they were talking about black skin or something black. Else.
Yeah, no, personally, I think black race. Now, that's personally what I feel. I think people just call it black hair because they're uncomfortable with any idea that there was a black race of people going around by boat being more advanced. I don't care either way. I just, you know, I don't see the point of mincing words, like, you know, that's what the Greeks was. The Hyperboreans, they were known as. I know there's other evidence, and I just uncovered from my sequel that the Hyperboreans were known to have a hallucinogenic drink. There's very strong reasons, I should say, that the Hyperboreans were associated with Callanish. There's an old reference by Diodorus Siculus, I think his name is. I can't pronounce his name properly. It's an old Roman book that was translated many years later. They wrote about the Hyperboreans, and the late Philip Coppens also wrote about the Hyperboreans being associated with Callanish. It's long been known that Callanish stone temple in the Outer Hebrides and northwest of Scotland is the only megalithic, it's the only structure of any kind or ancient temple that associates with the Hyperborean temple of the north. And the reason for that is it's on an island. It's got astronomical alignments to the Pleiades that only happens at that latitude. And it's also got alignments to the moon. And they talk about this 19-year lunar count being associated with this temple as well. It's got so many points of commonality, and it's the only one that fits it because it can't happen at any other latitude, because it's just the Pleiades alignment just doesn't work if you go 500 miles south. And it's the only thing there. So, you know, it's the only candidate. There is no other candidates, basically, Soraya. Now, I've also looked into the Newgrange acoustics mystery, and I guess I think the point is that, you know, I was looking at an acoustics mystery, you know, because these things aren't just astronomy-based. You know, there's acoustics inside these passage graves that are so advanced. Now, some people say that the rock art they were using hallucinogens, and that's why the rock art depicts altered states of consciousness. And it's very strong, dominating rock art that depicts these altered states of consciousness. And let's just say semicircles, spirals, and chevrons stacked on top of chevrons. And these are images that you would see going into an altered state of consciousness. Now, there's two routes into altered states of consciousness. There's acoustics, and there's hallucinogens or entheogens, whichever you like to call them. And, you know, were these people doing it? And I kind of thought I was, in my sequel, I would prove it either way, or, you know, I would at least try and look at the evidence for acoustics or hallucinogens. And I was aware of the rock art when I was trying to decipher the astronomy art. And you can only decipher some of the astronomy rock art because it's left to interpretation. But, you know, there is entoptic phenomena there as well that people don't really kind of get a hold of. And, you know, in my acoustics research, then I don't think it's just acoustics based. I think there's probably evidence to say that, you know, it's probably both. Like, you know, it's not as simple as that. It's not as simple as saying that these guys were going into these acoustic chambers and using acoustics only. I think, you know, the evidence also says that the Greeks wrote about the Hyperboreans having a hallucinogen drink that they used. Now, nobody knows what that drink was made out of. Was it psilocybin mushrooms, cactus, or like the blue lotus flower that the Egyptians had? You know, so there's evidence of ancient entheogens that we're not quite aware of. So yeah, my evidence kind of led me down that route, and again, linking up that way, so...
Okay, we got to take a quick 45-second break, and we're going to be right back with James Swagger.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking to James Swagger, and if you have any questions relating to what we're talking about, you can go into the chat at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com, just like that promo said. Now, James, what this information is actually very detailed that they're putting into these monuments. It's not rough, generalized information. Like you said, the lunar calendar or the lunar thing was 19 years, but isn't it 18 and a half? And they actually accommodate for that as well?
Sure, 18.6 years, I think. But yes, basically. The people refer to it as a 19-year cycle, but you know, it's basically, if you look up at the moon at any point in time, and you can basically count 19 later, you'll see the moon again in that exact same position. That's a rough general idea, but 18.6 years will do you as well. But to accommodate the 18.6 years to 19 years, all you have to do is look at about an extra 2 hours later at nighttime or something. You add on a couple of hours and it'll be in roughly the same position. But yes, a 19-year cycle. But yeah, these guys at NOTE, the evidence that I see is that they were calculating. People always think that NOTE, Passage Grave, is right beside Newgrange, and they think that it's got these alignments to east and west. The passages are aligned to east and west, but they're not exactly east and west. And they think that they're misaligned, but that's an incorrect way of thinking about it, Soraya. And they seem to have been able to calculate what's called a synodic lunar month and a sidereal lunar month. Now, there's not much in the difference of these two. It's basically a point of reference. I mean, you either reference the moon coming back to its own position, or you measure the background of the stars as a reference point. And basically, one is 27.3 days, and the other one's 29 and a half days. And that's what a sidereal lunar month and a synodic lunar month is. But the evidence is that they calculated both of these months, Soraya. And it's the only thing that explains these passageways being misaligned, quote, what the archaeologists think, to due east and due west, because they're not, they're 6 days off and 9 days off due east and due west, I think. And you know, that's quite a feat of engineering, just to calculate the sidereal and the synodic lunar month, you know, because you don't have, you know, decimalization, if you call it that. You know, you can't measure a bit of a day, you know, you're working in full days. So if you calculate 29 and a half days, you know, they've calculated three synodic lunar months and to do this, you know. And I go into that in the book, and that's one part of the cosmology, you know, to showing how much complex the cycles of the moon are and how they figured it out, and you know, that's just another aspect. You know, the solar phenomenon of the spring and autumn equinox and the summer and winter solstice seems to be a lot more easier to figure out than the moon cycles. But I mean, that the moon cycle then was taken, that's why they had a passage grave for each one of these aspects they were researching, Soraya. You know, they were demonstrating what they could do. They were demonstrating, yes, we can capture the beam of sunlight on the shortest day of the year, we can use that to find out something else, you know. And they figured out the complex moon cycles. You know, when you figure out the sun and you figure out your moon cycles, you've got to turn your eyes to the stars, and at evidence that they were figuring out deeper complex cycles of the stars as well. And I don't think they had everything figured out, Soraya. You know, that's one thing I do reckon. You know, I think there was always an element of research going on. But yeah, I mean, complex little entities, each one of these, I suppose. That's the thing to say, you know.
Right. And why do you think all over the world you see the same type of stars? Like, we see Sirius, we see the Pleiades, we see Cygnus, all over the place, not just in Europe. Why do you think these particular star formations are so important to ancient people?
You know, and I kind of go back to the Dogon element that, you know, the artwork that these guys are using, the symbology. I think the Dogon is a source of many ancient cultures. I know Laird Scranton's working on another element of tying the Dogon with another, you know, the Buddhist and Asian traditions, like. And I do think the Dogon had some aspect in Ireland, Soraya. I think, you know, did they come by boat? Did they have an ancient culture, you know, march out of ancient Egypt along the top of North Africa and go to the megalithic civilization? Did they have the same teachers?
Right.
I'm not quite sure on that. You know, I think this, I like to subscribe to them having the same teachers. Now, the Dogon, they talk about having their own teachers, Soraya. You know,
right,
they
yes.
they talk yeah. about the Numo, like, and that's quite controversial, like, you know. But I mean, they do say they had teachers. They do say that they came from, like, another star system, like, you know, it's out there, like. But mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know, facts are stranger than fiction sometimes, like, you know. But there is this is the thing about the Dogon. It seems to bind everything together. You know, the symbology that the Dogon use today, and the symbology that the ancient passage grave builders, you know, it's not just the same artwork, Soraya. That's the key thing to first point out. Yeah, it's the same artwork depicting the same complex concepts and themes. You know, and an example of that is this Dogon sun wheel that I call it. And the sun wheel depicts a heliacal rising. Now, they use sun wheels to represent the Pleiades. And they didn't just put the Pleiades anywhere. They put the Pleiades as it came on the horizon on a heliacal rising, on its own heliacal rising. And a heliacal rising is basically when a star comes up and gets quickly drowned out by the sun. Hence Helios, the sun, and a heliacal rising of a star is when it comes up and gets quickly drowned out. Now, the ancient Egyptians were obsessed with heliacal rising, and especially heliacal rising of Sirius, like. But again, the Dogon, you know, used these sun wheels for heliacal risings, and they did so at it's the same Dogon sun wheels that appear all over the megalithic art. They also appear in Malta at the Tal Kadi temple as well, on the pottery there, same Dogon sun wheel. But right there in Doth's passage grave, the Pleiades is the most clear representation as you can get, and it's using Dogon sun wheels to represent heliacal rising. So it's like so many points of commonality just on that one constellation, on that one piece of rock art right there. You know, but they also had the spiral as well, and they also have serpentine figures, weird leaf type drawings. They look like leaves with veins on them. You know, so they got such similar symbology representing the same things. There's also another one that's got, I haven't gone into in the Newgrange Sirius mystery, but I will be going into the Newgrange acoustics mystery because I've uncovered more stuff there, where they use this triple water wave logo. It's actually a hieroglyph as well. If you can picture one zigzag water wave drawing directly under another one, so again, this water wave, triple water wave logo is used by the Dogon and ancient Egypt, and it's eminent at the passage graves as well. So, you know, this Dogon element seems to bind everything together. Now, people just think, well, the Dogon are a modern tribe, but I just keep saying, you know, there's evidence that the Dogon go back many centuries at the very, very least. And how they're able to do that is they have this weird ceremony where they reenact the... It's to do with Sirius, and it's called the Sigi Festival. And, you know, they have masks that they make every year, and these masks, they make them every festival, and this festival is done every 50 years. It's a misnomer that it's been bandied about that it's 60 years, but that's not true. I've heard different sources of account for that, but Laird will tell you that it's 50 years, and he's not quite sure where the 60-year element comes in. It's true mistranslation of ideas. But this 50-year mask that they make, if you basically count up all the masks that they have in their archives, you can count them up and say, well, that's 50 years, 50 years, 50 years. And you can count them as far back as the masks are crumbling to dust because they're made out of wood.
Right.
So they can, yeah, and they're literally, you, if you count up all the masks, they will put you back in the middle ages, like about 13th century, I think, and 14th century. So you can only count them far back as they actually crumble to dust. But, you know, there's evidence that these guys also relocated as well. And, you know, there's evidence to go that brings them into that antiquity. They're heading in that direction. So they're not just a modern tribe. They have deep antiquity. And there's so many points of commonality with these guys at ancient Egypt. It's a whole other work in its own, Soraya.
Yeah. Well, Laird's definitely done a lot on that.
Sure.
Now, let's talk about Sirius for a moment. I know you're very familiar with Walter Cruttendon.
Sure, yeah. We don't actually agree on a couple of things, but that's okay. We've both been on each other's podcasts, you know.
Yes,
and
yes.
I like Walter. Walter's got a lot to say, you know.
Now there is some people who will say that Sirius does not actually move with precession, or it doesn't move the same as the rest of the stars, at least. Does that have any effect on your theory, if that turns out to be the case?
It does have an effect on the... Well, I have six theories in the book, like, and the Newgrange Sirius theory is one of them, so that's first and foremost. And I said to Walter, you know, I said, look, I don't profess to know everything. Mine's just a theory. He goes, as is mine, James, you know, and we both agree on that. We've both just got theories, but I don't agree with the precession of Sirius being altered, because I don't see enough evidence for it yet, Soraya.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, there's four other stars closer to us, Soraya.
Right.
And
right.
Basically, gravity would have to be ignored by the other four. Presuming it's gravity that's controlling the Sirius is the most... You know, I've done physics with astronomy and cosmology, and you know, you'd have to ignore so many cosmological principles out there. Like, well, first of all, you'd have to ignore the gravity effects of four different stars that are, you know, Sirius is the fifth star from us.
Right.
So there's four other stars there. You know, why aren't we orbiting them in a motion? I do like Walter's theory of a binary star and the binary theory of precession. I just don't think it's Sirius. Now, I know there's research out there about the Holmes. I've looked into it. Like, you know, he's mm-hmm. talking about the Holmes, but and these guys have been doing it for 20 years, but I don't think 20 years is enough to even accommodate a margin of error. Now, I haven't been there. I haven't seen their equipment. I haven't seen the detail that they're doing. You know, I just don't think 20 years is long enough. And I don't even know. You'd have to pull a figure of what is long enough. You know, I would think you need to see 100 years
right.
You know, of evidence. So that's where I kind of sit on that. But I really do like the binary theory of precession at Walter. And, you know, his own website is the Binary Research Institute, not mm-hmm. the Sirius Research Institute. It's not the only theory that he has, like, you know.
Oh,
but
no,
it's one that's thrown out there as a theory for Sirius line.
Well, I find it interesting because Sirius is so revered in so many different cultures. And,
sure.
And also, when you look at, like, the electric universe ideas, it's possible that they're... that our sun and Sirius are electrically connected, not just gravitationally connected.
Yeah, you know, I've got, you know, I'm not just a kind of rigid in my astronomy. Like, you know, I have looked into the work of Manuel Velikovsky, as has Laird Scranton. Like,
yes,
you know,
I
I'm open to that as well. Like, you know, that our own solar system might be fresher than we think it is. Like, you know, and Manuel Velikovsky did point out a lot of anomalies and proved them true. Like, you know, a lot of his predictions have come true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can be called a heretic for that if you like, but I have looked into Emanuel Velikovsky's work, like, you know, so I'm open to alternative ideas. I'm not rigid in all my stuff, like, you know, but I do know that the Dogon are obsessed with Sirius as well, and I just think it's, you know, I guess I think it's a strange end that Sirius theory. Then, you know, it's not rigid by any means. I like to think of it that, like, if Walter's right, then I'm totally wrong. But, you know, for Walter to be right, there has to be so many things wrong. So,
right. Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, it's a double-edged sword. Like, but I really like the binary theory of precession, though, and it's something, you know, it doesn't really affect all the things in my book, because it's only one key thing about Sirius that is probably the one red herring in the book, if you want to call it that. But again, I do think with the Carol Keel monuments that they were tracking precession through the Cassiopeia constellation, you know,
there's
evidence.
And why Cassiopeia?
Well, the thing about Cassiopeia is at the time the passage guys were built, Cassiopeia was sitting at it was rising on a winter solstice at a very northerly point, almost due north.
Hmm.
And the thing is, at a northerly the passage grades of Carroll Keel all open. The passages are all open to like 300 azimuth zero to is north. You know, and they're all within a few degrees of true north, like 352 degrees azimuth or 348 or whatever. You know, they're just about 10 degrees off the true north, and that closes down solar and lunar phenomenon because it doesn't happen at those extreme northerly latitudes.
Right.
You know, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Yeah, except for the winter solstice, it rises in the southeast and sets in the southwest, and the summer rises in the northeast and sets in the northwest. But it happens at due north. Like, so you've automatically ruled out the sun and the moon. Now that only leaves stellar phenomena out there. So, you know, you're naturally having to look at that those constellations, and not only that, you're narrowed down to two constellations: that's Cygnus and Cassiopeia. Now, the way they follow behind each other, Cygnus follows behind Cassiopeia. One would dip below the horizon and back up again. So you're only looking at two constellations, but when you look at the passage graves of Carroll Keel, each one of these passage graves seems to target a star of Cassiopeia, and it doesn't just target the star, it does it with extreme accuracy to with 1 or 2 degrees, you know. And it seems to take out each star as it sets on the horizon on the winter solstice. It's like a beacon saying, look at me, there's nothing else here to align this to, you know, and you're naturally led in that direction. Now the question is, why would they do that? I think they were aware of precession, and I think they would, you know, align things to stars, and maybe they were making sure that the whole constellation was being affected, and it wasn't just stars. You know, how would they didn't have complex computers to work out these complex motions, see it all right, moving together. You know, so they had to do it in stone. So they had to at least prove that the constellation was moving with precession, not just one star.
Maybe
they didn't know what precession was, Soraya. Maybe they were building a knowledge of precession, and that's why they had to have so many monuments to take out a constellation. At least know the constellation was doing it.
And could they also have left them, made them so big and made them so permanent so that we would find them at some point?
I don't think that would have been the intention. I think that, yes, they would have... At some point, would have been 100 years later. I don't think it would have been this long of epoch. Okay. Soraya. Okay. That's just my opinion, but I don't think it would have been a legacy for mankind, Soraya. It's something.
All right.
That's what you were hinting, but it would be nice to think so, wouldn't it? But the reason being is, you know, if you take out the other structures that the megalithic civilization was, like standing stones and stone rows, there's evidence that they have these stone rows to alignments, and you know, if you put a standing stone and you align it to a star, you know, give 100 years, precession is going to knock that out.
Right.
You're going to know 100 years from now that star isn't lined up with that stone, and if you've had generations watching it, Soraya, then you're going to know that something else is happening. It's not the solstice, and it's not anything else that you've been tracking, because you've done all that. You know all that. You've done the math. You've done the hard graphs. And you realize that there's some other cycle out there. And that's, I guess, how they knew that this precession was there. Maybe they didn't call it precession. They call it the great year, or as Walter would call it, or, you know, this grand cycle. There was a,
right,
you know. So knowing that it was there maybe have propelled them to figure out different methods of, you know, and that's why I like to think of the Carroll Keel complex. Now, Dose seems to have evidence that it was tracking the Pleiades. Maybe they tracked the Pleiades on the heliacal rising to make sure they could calculate precession as well. Now, you know, there's evidence that they had calculations on the sun wheels at Dose as well. So again, that's where you get lost in the complexity, because you're having to interpret, you know. That's why I tried to build the passage grade cosmology. I said, start with what we do know.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get the solstices out of the way. We know the lunar calculations. They were very advanced and all that. They were looking at constellations, and then what were they doing with the constellations? So you're naturally being led down this route to understand, well, we know they did all that much for sure, but what about this little bit at the end? We're not too sure about that. And that's the area of research that I'm trying to unveil what they were doing. Now, you're still leaving answers open at the end, but at least you're looking in the right direction, and you've got so far down the road, you know, you're so far down that path of discovery that, you know, you're not looking at this big complex problem. You're looking at a smaller part of the problem now, Soraya. So yeah, you know, this the procession thing is a funny one because, you know, it's people try to think about this long complex cycle of 26,000 years and how could they know that, but you know, it wasn't that, Soraya. I mean, they were building these monuments over centuries, like at least a few centuries, between 3000 and BC to maybe 3500 BC. And, you know, that's enough time for them to notice precession because you only need to see it for a couple of hundred years. A couple of hundred years, you're talking 3 degrees of precession. So that's noticeable on the horizon. And yeah, it's noticeable on your alignments, basically.
You have to suspect it's happening in the first place, too.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's maybe as far as they got. They knew it was happening and they couldn't figure it out. And, you know, maybe that was their area of research. Like, we've got cosmological areas of research today, like the Big Bang. We've got, like, you know, the expanding universe. How fast is it expanding, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we look at galaxies and relate how far they are from each other. And we measure their intensity of light, you know, to get ideas, and we look at supernovas going off, so that we use them as candles, basically. You know, these candles that have a stellar unit of luminosity that we are able to calculate, you know, how fast galaxies are and how far they are away from us, you know. So we have our own area of research going on, as well as stuff that we have figured out. Right. So, you know, in a similar way, you know, and that's why I talk about these guys had a cosmology. These guys were looking at the heavens, and they were doing it in an advanced way as they had their tools at their disposal.
Now, mainstream archaeology, I believe you said your book pretty much just looks at the solar alignments, correct?
Not even that, Soraya. Oh. I mean, some do and some don't. I mean, let's say, you know, the guy at Newgrange, who Michael J. O'Kelly, like, you know, he did a construction on Newgrange and put it back together, and, you know, and they realized that it was probably a solar. So yes, archaeology did address that there and then, but, you know, these guys have never hired in astronomers to look at these astronomical monuments. I just don't understand that. You know, just get an astronomer in and say, that's what I think. You can then tell them to go away, and, like, but archaeology doesn't like that, Soraya, you know. They want to be the ones, you know, and they and even I was just back in when I was in Malta there, and I just come back, you know, I couldn't believe, like, you know, that they're still over there. They're even worse because, you know, Malta is a very small group of islands. You know, they're a very small nation, and they're a very, very proud nation, and quite right they are. They've got some very deep history there, you know, but they don't want to look at the astronomy, and they say it can't be figured out. We can't know what the stars look like anymore. And that's just not right, Soraya. You know, we have complex computer programs to wind the stars back. Like,
right.
We can say what was there. We can model the motion of precession quite. People can do. Schoolboys are doing it now in the classroom. Like, you know, there's a wealth of a variety of planetarium software to do it for us. You know, and it's how people. You can plan out what you're going to look at next week, and you can look at what you did last week. You know, you can say what you looked like. The stars looked like in BC or AD or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you know.
Well, you brought up Velikovsky earlier, and I did have a question for you relating to Velikovsky's work. Now, one of the things Velikovsky says is that there was a change from 360 to 365 day years after Mars had made a close approach, and that would have been around the first century before the current era, which would be after these passage graves would have been built.
Sure.
So, is there any evidence that they were following a 360 versus 365-day solar year?
So you're saying Velikovsky modeled a 365-day change to a...
From 360. He's basically saying that before the first century BC, there is no calendar that actually accurately shows a 365-day year. He says the 5 days were all added in the first century.
Well, see, the difference with that is the passage grave builders, I think, were a bit calendar building, but, you know, I don't know how evolved their calendar was, Soraya.
Okay.
I guess the thing is they would have had a different way of looking at a calendar. They were basically picking days off the whole year. I mean, that maybe they weren't calculating 365 days. Maybe they were calculating how many days are in a month, 29 and a half. 27.3 for the sidereal and synodic lunar months. I think they were picking out days of the solar year, as in the spring and autumn equinox. I don't know whether they were calculating a full solar year to extreme accuracy.
Okay. It was just an interesting point, because if they had, if you had something that definitively said that at 3,500 BC, these people had a 365-day calendar.
Yeah, Velikovsky looks at that, you know, it says, you know, that's where the 360 degrees in the circle comes from, and that's the, it goes back to the Babylonians having that 60 degrees and 60 seconds, and, mm-hmm. you know, we get all that 60 seconds and minutes of and all from the Babylonians that we use in our time today, like, but again, the 360 degrees in the circle was probably modeled on that. You know, is there evidence for that in the megalithic civilization? I don't think so, because I don't think their calendar worked in that manner. I don't think they were interested in how many days were in a solar year. They were interested in what days of the year they knew they were looking at the same stars. Like, you know, they were using the calendar for a different reason.
Right.
You know, they didn't need to know how many days was in the year, but they did know at what points of the year. I think they broke the year into four, then they broke it into eight, and then they broke it into 16. And there is calendars, rock art, to depict that 16 rays and 16 points of the year. Now, maybe that was just ways of breaking the year down, but I don't think they had that extreme accuracy of, you know, the further they were breaking down these days, like, you know, it was getting a bit more complex for them, you know, and they were basically working in stone, so it was a bit difficult for them.
Right. Well, I was just looking to see if maybe there was some evidence one way or the other.
It's a good thought that you had there, yeah, sure. But I don't see, you know, it would be nice if they did have a, wouldn't it? It would have been nice if you could see that they had a 360-degree day calendar built out, like, but... I do think there's evidence that they were calculating in 5 days, though, you know, a 5 day week as opposed to, but I think their weeks just kept going on, like, you know, I don't think they had like a count of many weeks were in the solar year. Maybe they were trying to aim at that. Maybe they were trying to figure that out, you know?
Okay. But, now, you also talked very briefly in your book about Andrew Collins' work with Cygnus and the cosmic rays. And there's some thought that maybe the cosmic rays from Cygnus can actually affect us.
Yeah, you know, I like that theory with Andrew Collins. You know, and it's well thought out. I think it was in this documentary, The Cygnus Mystery. He has a documentary, a feature length documentary about that. Mm-hmm. But I tell you why. It was at a passage grave called Fornox, and you know, Fornox is aligned to the Cygnus constellation or Cassiopeia, but most predominantly, it was most likely the star Deneb of the Cygnus constellation. And again, this passage grave is 17 degrees off true north. Now, same reason again, there's nothing else, as there's a whole host of passage graves in Ireland with a few degrees, 17 degrees off north. It's a strange occurrence that all these passage graves have, you know, 17 degrees north of north alignment. So I don't think it's just one passage grave. And I think that these guys were looking at this Deneb constellation and quite possibly, you know, they're in a dark mound. And if, you know, again, Andrew Collins likens it to if they were in a cave, you know, or, you know, they would close their eyes, and the, if the Cygnus constellation that was flashing these radiation at us, like, you would see it on your retina. Now, the thing is, if that's true, and it flashed below, it would take the mass of the Earth to block out the radiation. So if it dropped below the horizon, basically you have the mass of the Earth blocking this radiation. Now, this radiation's so far away from us, like, Cygnus is so far away that, you know, it's not going to be that damaging to us, but it may actually affect our DNA. And when there's major bursts of energy coming off Cygnus, you know, stellar outbursts, you know, every now and again, how often this happens, I'm not so sure. But, you know, if it does happen, it may come and hit the Earth. Like, it's like a big giant torch beam shining at the Earth. And every now and again, there's a pulse comes out of it and comes in our direction like a bullet. It's looking down the like a rifle barrel. And it may just jump our DNA every now and again and affect us, like. But again, the passage grave builders may have been aware of this, like, you know, there seems to be so many of these. There's actually another one called Seafin Hill. Now, I didn't go into Stephen Hill in the book. I think I may have mentioned it, but it has a lot of quartz in it, and the passageways are aligned with quartz. You know, I'm working on an element that they actually may have had fertility problems around the passage grave era, 3200 BC to 3000 BC, and the quartz element may have been affected. But again, this one that has the most quartz in it is aligned to the Cygnus constellation. So, you know, were they taking in the starlight from Deneb and making it reflect off the quartz inside the passage grave? I mean, it's actually got the whole walls of the passageway, the upright walls, lined with quartz. They've actually worked away the vein of quartz to expose a thick layer of quartz and used it like a quartz sheet almost, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, insane. I mean, these guys were revered quartz. I mean, they took all the quartz from County Wicklow and shipped it like about 40 kilometers due north to Newgrange. That's where the Newgrange quartz comes from, the Stephen Hill Mountains, where the Stephen Hill passage grave. But Stephen Hill's little known about. Nobody knows about it, like, you know, and it's one of the most important ones because it's got the most quartz in this lined passageway. But the key thing about that passageway is it's the same as Fornox. It's aligned to the Cygnus constellation. You know, and there may be I was talking to another author there, and I was about, it may have been like a fertility clinic, you know, where it changed the light inside to make it more magnetic. You know, the quartz would reflect the electromagnetic properties of the light and make it more magnetic. It would change it another 45 degrees because the electro part and the magnetic part are 90 degrees apart. Yeah, these two waves that make up the electromagnetic wave are 90 degrees apart. But having the quartz in there would change the magnetic component or the electric component to be more magnetic. It would shift it almost. So there may have been and the magnetic element would then help fertility, like, you know. So,
right.
Again, that's out there, but, like, you know, it's a complex idea. There's complex ideas already going on at these with the acoustics and the astronomy.
Yeah, they weren't just for one purpose.
No, multifaceted complex monuments, that's what they were. But there is these weird fertility rites going on at these. It's an element I didn't go into in the book. Again, it didn't serve me for the archaeoastronomy. Again, I could have gone off on so many tangents, and I just wanted to contain just the archaeoastronomy. That was my aim in the book, start to finish. And it was very difficult to start the book, as you quite rightly put out, Sir Ryan, and you really have picked up on that. There's so much data to give to the reader.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you got to kind of give them something so they understand what you're talking about in the first place.
You know, and I kind of say, like, these guys were astronomers, like, you know, you have to talk about astronomy and you have to kind of tell people, you know, that's what they are, that's the size of the mountain, that's how difficult it is to build, that's what they're aligned to. And yeah, and I had to go through so much kind of complex data just to raise the awareness of the reader, you know, and it's not that complex. As you say, it's an easy read. I've tried to leave it in a digestible manner. I could have talked about complex theories of precession, but I tried to give it just what the reader needs to get through the book and to give the cosmology in a layman's term, although there is some other stuff in there that's probably a bit more complex. But, you know, the point is that, you know, I could have gone off on many different tangents, but, you know, for the purpose of the book and the archaeoastronomy, like, get through the data at the start and get in some of the art and the explanations, and, you know, kind of show where roads are heading in the book. Like, you know, mm-hmm. All roads head to complex advanced astronomy at the very least, you know, solar and lunar, and possibly trying to work with constellations and figure them out. Like.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're almost out of time. You're at WVBR FM Ithaca. This book, now, what's your website?
Yeah, jamesswagger.com is for my author's page. You can find all my books there. For the book we're talking about is newgrangecosmology.com. Okay. But again, that's all linked up on jamesswagger.com. That's two G's for swagger, jamesswagger.com.
And you have a new book coming out. When do you think that'll be?
That'll be hopefully this summer. That's the Newgrange Acoustics Mystery, which is a follow-on book. And basically, it's a book about archaeoacoustics and I guess I have a different route into the start of the book. It's not as heavy going at the start. It kind of goes into a lot of acoustics mysteries of you know, ancient cultures, the Egyptians, the Mayans, the Greek amphitheaters, and the Neolithic age. You know, Stonehenge acoustics, you've got all these elements of acoustics of ancient cultures. And again, I have some more links with the Dogon again. And, you know, I think the Dogon are one of, that's the thing to kind of end on, I suppose, right? That the Dogon are one of the most important cultures out there because they're, you know, they survived. They survived the test of time. Right. And it's a miracle that they did, Soraya. It is an absolute miracle that they did. But they resisted outside influence. And, you know, they've given us so much knowledge about Sirius, you know. Kind of another thing, a point to note, I think if we did orbit Sirius, I think the Dogon would have been able to tell us that because they told us so much else about Sirius.
True.
And I'm a firm believer in that, you know, that, you know, a lot of what the Dogon say is like, is truth. Like, to them, it's history, Soraya. To us, it's their mythology. And I don't, you know, I say that as a third person, like, but, you know, I don't feel that. Like, I don't like calling their history mythology. That's like an insult to them, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you say you've got a history and I turn around and go, that's a nice mythology, it's not a nice way of saying this. But, you know, but I do believe in a lot of what they say, you know, and I think, you know, they accurately talk about the orbit of Sirius around its parent star, like Sirius B and Sirius A, and mm-hmm. also Sirius C as well. It's a triple star system, and, you know, they talk about spiral galaxies, and they talk about the heavy density of the dwarf star, which is white and heavy, like, you know, and, you know, it's fascinating what these guys talk about, like, you know, and they also talk about the Pleiades as well, which not a lot of people talk about, you know, and they're Nummo, their teachers, they also talk about coming from the Pleiades line.
Yeah, yeah. All right, and you also do your own radio show.
Yeah, I do Capricorn Radio, similar to yourself, Soraya. I get guests on and do a book review. I like to do a good thorough book review. Sometimes I get film producers on, or I hope to have that other guy I was talking about. But, you know, it's not necessarily documenters, film producers, or mostly alternative history authors or alternative science. So, yeah, you know, CapricornRadio.com for that. You know, I've got some interesting guests coming up there. Mostly I've concentrated on ancient Egypt and the Dogon as well, like, you know, because that's where my interests lie. But I am trying to broaden the horizons later on in the year and go outside my own personal field. But I guess a lot of the core of the shows so far would have been ancient Egypt, Dr. Robert Shuck, Carmen Boulter, Christopher Dunn, and all that, like, mm-hmm. and you know, so.
All right. Well, it is linked on wheredidtheroadgo.com. You can find it right down on the left-hand side if you want to check out Capricorn Radio. And maybe we can have you back when you get your next book published this summer.
Sure, yeah. As I said, at the very earliest, I think the Kindle will be out in June or July, all being well. But yeah, it's coming to a close now. I had to wait till I went to Malta to finish off some of the acoustics. I should just say, on, you know, the thing about the acoustic element binding the whole civilization together is, I think we're talking about an astronomy-based civilization and an acoustic-based civilization. Mm-hmm. Physical scientific principles are equals in the ancient civilization, the megalithic builders, you know. And when you look at the hypogeum, this ancient underground man-made cave system, you know, it's got a primary resonance that resonates at the male vocal range, you know, and it's an intentionally designed hollowed out temple underground, you know, where they buried their dead. You know, they got spirals inside. You know, the ancient chambers of Newgrange also have the primary resonance with the male vocal range. You know, there's so many points of commonality with these ancient cultures, like, and, you know, the hypogeum in Malta is one of the most advanced ancient acoustic monuments what we have, like, you know, and having been there now and seen it from my own eyes, like, it's just astounding, like, you know, it's got so many complex engineered aspects to it, you know, wow. That we're looking at an ancient lost culture, Soraya, that it was acoustics based as well as astronomy based. You know, as if the astronomy wasn't enough, Soraya, we have this acoustics, you know. But I think the acoustics thing, you know, again, it's bringing it back to an altered state of consciousness, this paranormal effect on the brain that, you know, they were trying to synchronize their hemispheres of their brain. And, you know, there's a healing aspect to it, like, you know, where they were able to work at a different intellect or a different level or, you know, a more astute awareness by synchronizing the hemispheres to their brain. And this has been proven today in the lab, like, you know, with theta frequencies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these passage grays seem to have this thing going on as well, that, you know, acoustics and altered states of consciousness, they're synonymous with each other, like.
All right. Well, one more time, what's your website?
JamesSwagger.com for my author's page. It links all my work and all my books. And the book is available at NewgrangeCosmology.com if you want to buy it there. You get a signed copy. And you'll also get the free PDF version with the paperback as well if you buy the paperback there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the interview and for the work you're doing. And next week on Where'd the Road Go, we have Dr. Rita Louise talking about her book, Man-Made. And we're going to take you out right now with some Psyche Corporation and then into the last exit for the loss. Thanks, James.
Thanks, sir.
Numbered 1597 and counting.